When it was founded in 1980, the freshness of the PT's vision won the support of thousands of young industrial workers who had been brought up under the military dictatorship, when left-wing parties were banned. Bombarded by pro-government propaganda on the television and radio, the vast majority of these workers did not define themselves as left-wing, let alone socialist. Most of them probably adhered to the practice, widespread at the time, of using the word comunista as a routine swear word. But they knew what they wanted: better wages, better working conditions, great political freedom, and the right to reorganize their trade union movement so that it would truly represent their interests. Luis Ignacio da Silva quickly emerged as the leader of this new labor movement. Lula is a born leader with a remarkable capacity to captivate an audience. Factory workers will happily stand for half an hour or more in the hot sun or pouring rain, listening to him. He thinks well on his feet and speaks from the heart, as he explained in a recent interview.
I don't know if it is weakness or not, but to speak frankly, I often prefer to rely on my intuition than to work things out in my head. I think that intuition lets you put a bit of your heart in things. And I think to do politics without your heart makes people very hard, very realistic. I don't think that that's good in politics. I don't think that you can be a good politician without deep human feelings.
Brazil's industrial workers feel an immediate affinity with Lula, who, until he became a national figure, had lived a life much like their own. He was born on the 27th of October in 1945 in Garanhuns, in the poor northeastern state of Pernambuco. His parents were impoverished subsistence peasants, and Lula was the seventh of eight children. Shortly after he was born, his father, like hundreds of thousands of others from the Northeast, made the long journey down to the state of Sao Paulo in search of work. He got a job in the docks in the port of Santos, loading bags of coffee. The first time Lula remembers seeing his father was when he came back to visit the family, when Lula was 5 years old. Back in Pernambuco, Lula's mother, Eurídice Ferreira de Melo, struggled to feed and educate her children. Often they went to bed hungry. Overwhelmed by the effort, Lula's mother decided in December of 1952 to leave the Northeast and, with her eight children, to join her husband in Sao Paulo State. The 3,000-kilometer journey in the back of an open lorry took them 13 days. At first, the family went to live with the father in Vicente de Carvalho, a poor neighborhood in the seaside resort of Guarujá, near Santos. To boost the family income, Lula, age 7, sold peanuts, tapioca, and oranges in the streets.
Pai, afasta de mim esse cálice. Pai, afasta de mim esse cálice. Pai, afasta de mim esse cálice.
But the reunion between Lula's parents did not work out. Like so many other Brazilian men, Lula's father had started living with another woman. In fact, a cousin to his first wife, during the years he was separated from his first family. In 1956, Eurídice decided to move with her children to Sao Paulo. Partly perhaps because he never knew his father properly, Lula developed a very close and warm relationship with his mother. Even today, he refers frequently to his mother's pride and happiness when he finally got his technical diploma, and his regret that she did not live long enough to see him running for the presidency. It is an experience with which many poor Brazilian men and women can identify, in a country with a high level of internal migration and, as a result, numerous broken marriages. Once in Sao Paulo, the whole family lived in a single room behind a bar. They had to share the toilet with the customers. Later, Lula recalled his embarrassment at inviting friends home from school because there was no chair for them to sit on. It was then, he says, that for the first time he realized that his family was poor. At 12, Lula got his first full-time job, working in a dry cleaner's. After being sacked, he looked around for other odd jobs, working as a boot black and then as an office boy. He got these jobs in the informal labor market, with none of the benefits guaranteed in the labor legislation. At 14, Lula got his first registered job working in a warehouse. Later, he found work in an engineering company, and as a result, managed to enroll on a 3-year part-time course to train as a lathe operator. During this period, he had an accident during a night shift. He was replacing a nut on a machine while a colleague held down the brake. Off. The blade slipped forward, cutting off Lula's little finger on his left hand. He was 18 years old at the time. Apart from work, his main interests were girls and soccer. He was a keen supporter of the Corinthians Football Club in Sao Paulo. In 1966, Lula started working at Villares, one of the biggest engineering firms in the country. In May 1969, he married Maria de Lourdes, a young worker in a textile factory. The following year, both Maria and her baby died during labor. She had been suffering from hepatitis, but it had not been diagnosed by the doctors. In 1973, Lula had a brief relationship with a young nurse, Miriam Cordeiro, in a development that was to have important political consequences later. They had a daughter and called her Luriam, following the practice common among the Brazilian working class of inventing a new name by combining the father's name with the mother's. The following year, Lula married Marisa Leticia, a widow with one son. Marisa and Lula have 3 children, all boys. So far, there had been nothing to distinguish Lula's life from that of thousands of other migrants from the Northeast, with similar tales of hunger, suffering, and limited social advancement, despite years of effort. But Lula then shot to national prominence as the leader of the massive waves of strike that swept through Sao Paulo's industries in 1978 and 1979, and by setting up what has become Latin America's most important left-wing political party. This story is told using Lula's own words and those of his colleagues, using testimony recorded by several authors, particularly the Chilean sociologist Marta Harnacker in her excellent book O Sonho Era Possível. Other sources include Without Fear of Being Happy by Emir Sader and Ken Silverstein and Lula O Metalúrgico Autonomia de Uma Liderança by Marco Morel. According to Lula, his first contact with the union movement came through his brother, José Ferreira da Silva, known as Friar Chico because of his monk-like haircut. As a member of the banned Brazilian Communist Party, Lula's brother was active in underground politics. In 1969, he asked Lula, then working at an engineering plant in São Bernardo, an industrial town at the outskirts of São Paulo, to stand on his slate in the elections for the Directorate of the Metalworkers Union of São Bernardo and the Diadema. After reluctantly agreeing to stand and be elected, Lula gradually became more involved in the union, but never followed his brother into the Communist Party. Though he refused to define himself ideologically, he became firmly opposed to the existing union leadership. In 1979, he was elected union president with 92% of the vote. At that time, the Union Federation was controlled by Pelegos, conservative union leaders who worked closely with the employers. Oddly enough, Lula was nominated for the presidency by the outgoing union head, Paulo Vidal, one of the old guard. With hindsight, Lula believes he was being used in an internal power struggle.
I had never spoken at a union assembly, had never used the microphone. So, and this is a supposition, when Paulo agreed to nominate me, he was planning to prove, not just to the directorate, but to all the workers as well, that he was irreplaceable and that I was a shit and I couldn't get a damn thing done.
If this was Paulo Vidal's hidden agenda, his plan backfired. A turning point for Lula came the year he was elected. His brother, Friar Chico, was arrested and charged with being a communist subversive. Lula learned of his brother's arrest during a brief stopover in the United States on his way back from a conference in Japan, his first trip abroad. When a lawyer advised Lula to stay in the USA for a while until the situation cooled down,
"Look, my friend, I don't speak the language of the people here. I've got no money, the food stinks, there's no rice, there's no beans. I'd rather be arrested in Brazil than stay in this dump of a country. Before, I had been a typical union leader. I had been afraid of being arrested. I had been worried about my family. I had never thought that being a union activist required very much. But after my brother was arrested, I lost my fear."
But, as we shall see, his recollection contradicts the testimony of several other activists, particularly that of the actress Lelia Abramo. Lula may have lost his inhibitions, but not, it seems, his fear. Buoyed up by his new militancy, Lula sought to change the way unions operated, improvising as he went along. When he took over, unions were largely apolitical. Workers did not look to them to support demands for higher wages or better working conditions. Members mostly went to the unions to obtain subsidized health treatment and other social benefits. They only sprang into life during the annual wage negotiations, and even then, the wage increase was often worked out behind closed doors. In keeping with the government's wage policy at the time, there was no direct bargaining between unions and employers. Wage increases were set by the government for the whole industry. Lula and the other young union leaders working with him decided that all this must change, but they began by making what seems to be small changes.
"Our first big decision was not just to wait for workers to come to union assemblies at the time of our annual wage increase, but for us to seek them out at the factory gates and get them involved in other issues. We knew we had to get the workers to have more trust in us. So do you know what I did? I started to arrange football championships, the union leadership against factory teams. Before the matches began, I used to talk to the workers for 5 minutes. After the game, we had a few beers and cooked a barbecue. I noticed that workers used to throw away the bulletin we gave them at the factory gates when they were 50 yards or so down the road. I realized that they were chucking it away because it had nothing in it that interested them. So we decided to liven it up, to introduce cartoons, to turn it into an attractive 4-page leaflet. The result? The workers didn't throw it away, but put it in their pocket to read inside the factory. In a short time, we managed to create a new awareness. Before, the union building had always been empty. No one took part in anything. But soon, all our assemblies were crowded. What was the great advantage in doing this? It was to make the workers feel that the union belonged to him, was a body that would fight for him, go on the offensive for him. For instance, we did something that the workers loved. We printed in our journal the names of the line managers who treated them unfairly. In all, I think we achieved in 3 years things that normally in this country would have taken 30.
In this unconventional way, Lula and the other leaders developed a union movement that in 1978 was able to mount the first serious challenge to the military government. Rejecting the wage rise offered by the government, the metal workers opted for industrial action. The strike erupted in the Subscania truck company in Sao Bernardo, spreading rapidly to other multinational companies such as Ford, Mercedes-Benz, Volkswagen, and Chrysler.
It was the first general strike since 1968, and it received enormous support from all over the country. In this way, our 1978 strike meant for Brazilians what the Gdansk strike meant for the Poles. It was the first time that the Brazilians' working class had shown such strength.
Far more than the other strike leaders, Lula was determined not to allow left-wing intellectuals to rush in and take over control of the strike movement. He stopped students from joining the pickets outside the factory gates, saying that they shouldn't get directly involved in a workers' struggle. To the irritation of some of his supporters, he frequently repeated a phrase made famous by a samba school in Rio. It's intellectuals who love poverty. What the poor like is luxury. One of the big names in Brazilian theater, a committed left-wing actress named Lélia Abramo, recalls this.
I wanted to get involved in the strike movement, so I went to São Bernardo to see Lula, but he refused to talk to me. He had something against artists, students, and intellectuals. But the others, Djalma Baum, Devenir, and Jaco Bitar, they didn't feel the same way. In the end, I managed to be quite useful. As I had been in Europe during the war, I knew how to distribute food parcels. I showed Devenir how to weigh out the rice in 1 kilogram, 2 kilogram bags, and so on. He was very grateful. And in this way, I got to know Lula. He finally started to talk to me, and we became close friends.
The 1978 strike took the government and the manufacturers completely by surprise. By the end of May, the union had won a 24.5% pay raise from the manufacturers, much more than their original offer. But according to Lula, the wage increase was not the strike's main achievement.
The great victory, even more than the wage rise, was that we forced the companies to negotiate an agreement directly with the union, without government interference.
Other strikes soon erupted in a number of industries around the country. By the end of the year, over 500,000 workers were on strike, and many won pay raises above those authorized by the government. The government's wage policy had come under serious threat for the first time. By the following year, however, the government was better prepared. The Metal Workers Union in São Bernardo called a general strike for the 13th of March, demanding a pay increase and improved working conditions. The response was overwhelming. The general assemblies, called by the union, had to be held in the Vila Euclides football stadium, the only place capable of holding more than 80,000 people.
When we, the union leaders, arrived, the fences, the stadium, the grass, everywhere was full of people, and the podium was only a little table. The sound system wasn't even big enough for a small room, and I was alone, like a clown, on top of the table. Everyone was getting tense, and the leaders were beginning to argue, because the sound system wasn't any good, and who knows what else was wrong. And the workers said, "Calm down, calm down. You know what we did? We kept them there for 4 hours on the field without sound. I yelled, the people in front of me repeated what I'd said, and it was passed backwards. When it started to rain, a few people started to leave. I shouted that no one there would dissolve in the rain, and nobody else went away."
The strike was soon declared illegal. But Lula, showing a new willingness to take on the authorities, told a union assembly that they can declare the strike illegal, but it is just and legitimate, because its illegality is based on laws that weren't made by us and our representatives. The experience was important for all the new union leaders.
I think that the first big lesson for us was that not one of us individually believed that we could do what we did. None of us believed that every blessed day, come sun, come rain, we could get 90,000 workers in a football stadium. And when we were gathered there, all together, we realized that if we pulled our courage together, we became a giant. Individually, we all had qualms. We thought, we can't do this, we can't do that. But together, we did things that individually we thought impossible. I had been banned by the authorities. It wasn't easy to take over running the strike again. But when I realized that what I was doing was causing serious problems for the movement, I decided to go back, even if it meant putting my neck on the guillotine.
There must have been about 2,000 people there. He walked around the room, and then, when he reached the head table, he burst into tears, started to sob. He was cheered. It lasted for at least 10 minutes. He recovered himself and made a wonderful speech. For the first time, he aligned himself politically with the opposition. He had never done this before.
Even so, the strike was by no means an unqualified success. On March 21st, 8 days after the strike began, the labor minister agreed to talks between the unions and their employers, but insisted first on an immediate return to work by the strikers. This was overwhelmingly rejected by the strikers, but after heavy intimidation by the military police, many people began to drift back to work. In an effort to limit the damage, Lula accepted the employer's proposal for a 45-day truce and a 15% wage rise, in exchange for a promise not to carry out reprisals, sackings of union militants. Lula's handling of the negotiations was bitterly criticized by many workers and some of his fellow union leaders. He was even jeered in the stadium when he explained his actions.
Ooh.